and the invitation to be here. It's a topic very close to my heart that I'm very excited about. And, you know, I think we've already talked a bit about some of the many compelling reasons to think about data issues, data sharing, access to data. But I think a lot of us are drawn to these data discussions because we're living in such an exciting time when we recognize that the connectivity is unprecedented. The data generation is huge, and our computing power is growing at scales that we never would have imagined 10, 20, 30 years ago. And so the possibility for using data crunching to improve human lives is apparent all around us and to all of us as individuals, and certainly even to non-scientists. Just thinking about how much we rely on algorithms to crunch data for our transportation safety, for example. That's just part of our lives, that we are using the products of this sort of data crunching, access to data, computing power every day, and we appreciate it. And this is coming at a time when the scale of our environmental problems also is becoming increasingly apparent, that we are being asked by society to work at much larger scales and in a more integrative way than we ever have before. So this is an example from Ben Halpern and a large group of collaborators where they've integrated all of the data that they could find and do quality assurance on to understand what the cumulative effects of humans are on the oceans globally. So addressing environmental problems at the scales that they're actually occurring globally. And this is the sort of effort that is now possible and very much needed by society. Now, this is really a challenge for me as an ecologist, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the field of ecology, but I'm saying that mainly because I know that this is the way that it is in ecology, or I'm pretty sure. But I also suspect that it's true of the disciplines that are represented in this room as well. The idea that ecology has a very individualistic history, and so when we try to do these large collaborative integrative analyses, and when we talk about data sharing with people that you've never met, you're really bucking up against tradition and structures that were really structured around an individualistic history. And this history of individualism is really reflected in our funding patterns as well. So this is a figure from Brian Heidorn's paper where he talks about the long tail of data distribution. And so what you're looking at is the size of an award, in this case from National Science Foundation, on the y-axis, and on the x-axis is the number of awards that are sorted by size. And you can see that there are lots and lots of small projects that are taking place in very geographically dispersed locations by individual researchers. And there's only a few projects that are these really big awards. So I put them up here on the telescope end and the rest of us down here on the duct tape experiment end. So this is about awards, and it's sort of reflecting our individualistic history and practice, and there's many good reasons that funding is structured this way. For example, this idea of let many flowers grow, fund many, many different fantastic ideas. So there's great reasons for funding to happen this way, but you know, one of the results, unfortunately, is that the data resulting from these efforts can suffer. There are certainly economies of scale in doing data management for these large-scale projects. These large-scale projects tend to be the ones that have actual humans whose dedicated job is working on data management and data sharing. It's fantastic. These smaller projects, at least in the field of ecology and I think in most other fields that are represented in this National Science Foundation study, there are not dedicated people working on data management and data sharing. And this is what Heidorn identified as this long tail of the distribution where we see dark data, or rather we don't see the data, but they're called dark data. So they exist somewhere, probably on somebody's obsolete storage device. and I think I'm talking to a sympathetic audience here. So we asked ourselves, and this is a paper where most of this information is represented, is in this Frontiers in Ecology and the Environment paper. So we asked, okay, let's look at ecology specifically. That Heidorn paper is looking at broad fields of science. And do we see that? Yes, we see that that same funding pattern is reflected in ecology with lots and lots of small projects. And we can infer that these are small projects where you really can't find the data, that we're unlikely to find them, and they probably are dark data. But before we start embarking on a study like this where we investigate the causes of dark data, we should probably ascertain that they are indeed dark data, that we can't find them. And so we ask the question, how dark are ecology's dark data? And this is really difficult to assess, as Carol knows more intimately than pretty much anybody else I know. This is a really difficult question to ask, because when we do surveys or other methods of trying to understand our community's practices, frequently the people who will take the time to answer your question are people who actually care about data for one reason or another. And it's much tougher to engage with the people who just don't even care enough to talk to you about data. And so the way that we approach this after many discussions about how we would get a hold of this is we decided to take a real boots on the ground kind of approach to figuring out how accessible are ecology's data. And what I mean by this is that we're just taking the place of who we are. We are research scientists. And let's say I wanted to find some scientific data that are associated with a publication. Can I do it? Can I find those data? And so we randomly selected 100 studies from National Science Foundation's Division of Environmental Biology, which is the division that funds most of the ecology research. And then we randomly selected one paper from each of those projects and read the paper. And I keep saying we, and I should say that Carly Strasser is the person who did all of the effort on this part of the project, and she was fantastic doing this. So she read the paper and then made reasonable efforts to locate the data. And by this, I think we're really putting ourselves in the shoes of a researcher. So you look in the paper, does it indicate any data availability at all? And if it doesn't, well, my next step would be to go look at the websites of the authors and see if there's any indication of data sets. If I don't see that, I am seriously going to Google, and then I'm going to have some sort of cutting off point where I just can't Google any longer. And so we stop just short of contacting the researcher, because realistically, this is what people do. That if you have to contact 15, 20 different people to say, do you have data on this specific bug, and was it collected in this specific environment? You're just not going to do it. So there is a giving up point, and so that's what we did in this study. And what we found matched our gut instinct, that only 8% of these projects could we locate any information, any data associated with these paper. And I should specify non-genetic data, because as many of you may be aware, people using genetic data pretty much solved this quite some time ago, and now their culture actually encourages data submission to the point where even if the journal they're submitting to doesn't require them to archive their genetic data, they still archive it. That was also one of the ancillary findings in this study. So if we set aside the genetic information, for which there are some strong cultural norms already in place, we see that the non-genetic information simply wasn't shared. And so when I say 8% of the projects had any available, I really mean not all the data, not even most of the data, but where we could locate any of the data that were used in that publication. And that really, unfortunately, matched our gut instinct rather well. And it was interesting, in the course of this study, of course, you are looking at literature from lots of different fields. And one of the papers I looked at was somebody who was analyzing the adherence to these data protocols for genetic researchers of various kinds. And his paper said, can you believe it? Not everybody is sharing their data. Only 94% of the papers I looked at, could you find all of the genetic data? I was like, whoa, 94%? That sounds like measurement error could take care of the rest. That sounded pretty awesome to me. So unfortunately, yes, it is still true that it's hard to find. So why are these data dark? And luckily, we've been talking about this quite a bit already this morning. Some of these issues I'll try to address more from this perspective of this individual scientist who is mostly who I have worked with in large collaborations and who we were studying in this paper. So this idea that you don't want to lose your rights. Maybe you've published some using these data sets, and then you don't really want to lose your rights to work with those data, be involved in those data, and really get credit for those data. So writing clear metadata is one of the ways that you can indicate what you would like to happen. You can indicate your willingness to collaborate, and you can also ask people to cite the data set in the way that you would like it cited, whatever it is that your organization would really like. This idea that someone will steal my data, both Carol and Cliff talked a little bit about this. So one of the ideas to keep in mind as an individual researcher is that publishing your data really establishes your priority in this field and with these data. So it's a really clear way to say, I collected these data. I'm an expert in this field. Here they are. I'm your point person to come to. And, you know, really I've probably been involved in this kind of research, this large-scale, integrative data synthesis sorts of research, and this is really the way that it plays out in our community, that somebody has published a large data set, they get a reputation for being a fantastic collaborator and a real go-to person. It's a very clear way to establish your priority on a topic. And also, as both Cliff and Carol referred to, stealing is not common. So there was an analysis done of the journals that are published by Ecological Society of America, and they published about 600 papers a year, something like that. And they estimated that only once every 3 years do they have any sort of dispute arise around data use, and that those disputes were not with strangers. They were with colleagues and former students. So it's not the sort of scenario that lots of people imagine when they think of, you know, when they fear publishing their data. This is also reflected in looking at the dynamics around the downloads of data from the long-term ecological research network. So that's a research network or sites and a network that are funded by National Science Foundation, and they do have explicit data sharing requirements for all of the sites. And so there's some good information about the data downloads and what happens around these data downloads. And less than 1% of those generated any sort of detectable problems, and none of them were about infringement on somebody's intellectual property. There were different sorts of disputes or concerns raised. So, yeah, at least as I have also tried to keep my ear to the ground to answer that question, you know, what are the disputes that may have occurred when somebody has access to somebody else's data? And so far, I don't have good concrete examples. Rather, you know, what comes to mind for me are all the disputes that arise when people can't find the data, they can't replicate somebody's results, and there's a lack of transparency in the way that research was done. Now, this is the one that I have a huge amount of sympathy. I have sympathy for all of these. I'm a research scientist myself. But this is the one that I think is the really tough one, is that sharing data management and data sharing takes time, and it does take money. That is true. So, and the best thing I can say is budget for it. And that's really easy to say if you're at the point right now where you're writing a proposal and you're writing the budget into your proposal. It's harder to say sort of retroactively when you're sitting on a big mountain of data and you're trying to figure out what to do with it. I totally get that. I empathize. I guess it was about 5 years ago, I wrote my first data manager into a grant. And so She, in her role, she was not just managing data and working on the data archive, but she was also really supporting our analyses. And ultimately, she became somebody who really became a lab manager. So, you know, my research group relies on her, our data manager, in the same way that, you know, 10 years ago I relied on a lab manager, that she performs this wide range of functions that support our research, because our research is really data intensive. And what you can do when you have somebody who has those data handling skills and can prep data for analyses, in addition to working on proper management practices and archive, is just astonishing. I will never go back. As long as I'm funded, I will have a data manager, and it's fantastic. Okay, so why should we go through this exercise and thinking about how we can change our practices? And this, I am, again, taking the perspective of an individual researcher. It's because the landscape is changing. And if we don't change our practices, I am not afraid to say that I think we will become irrelevant. The landscape is changing in ways that you guys are all aware of, we're all aware of, that remote sensing data is becoming more accessible, is becoming cheaper, is generally flooding our environment with really cool measurements and new ways to think about large-scale questions. In addition to that, funding agencies are really interested in this idea of setting up environmental observatories with the express purpose of making data publicly available. And this is a fantastic opportunity. So I'm showing the example of the National Ecological Observatory Network, NEON, which will provide ecological data at continental scales. Really exciting, but it's only one of the observatory initiatives out there. So think about ocean observatories is happening. There are a new call for long-term ecological research sites from NSF. Department of Energy is thinking about urban monitoring and making those data public. And certainly LTAR, the Long-Term Agricultural Research Network, is a hot topic right now as well. So it's a really exciting time when lots of data are going to become available, and as individual scientists collecting really critical observations, we need to think about how our data plugs into those networks of large-scale data. And I like to use this picture of Megan McKenna and John Kalambakidis tagging a whale in the Santa Barbara Channel as an example, because what they're doing here is they're putting a tag on a whale that's then going to go through the series of diving and breathing activities that we don't know any other way to collect these data. It's not something we can pick up from drones and satellites or acoustics, but really, you know, driving a Zodiac boat up to a whale that's briefly surfacing and then using incredible skill to place a monitor on this animal that'll stay on it for a few hours. And then Megan goes back and she plugs this information, her observational data on the whale behavior, into larger data streams that allow her to create the acoustic landscape of the environment in which this animal is doing these diving behaviors. And it's really critical research in this case because she's working in an area where there are ship strikes occurring, and they're trying to understand the behavior of the animal relative to the ships and how they may avoid it. And so, you know, here she's using her expertise, John's expertise on whales, and this incredible ability to tag them to collect data that we cannot rely on observatories and remote sensing to do. The individual researcher is vital in this environment, and we need to be thinking about how we keep reminding our community that we are important, we are relevant, and that we understand how to take these data and plug them into these larger data streams. Now, I think an important thing that so far I think has been implicit, and I want to be really explicit about in this talk, is that as we scale our research up and as we integrate our data sets across all of the hand-collected data and the large data streams, that these are products that are high-impact research. And these are the sorts of integrative syntheses that are increasingly dominating the scientific landscape, that people are using these sort of data integrations to ask large-scale questions that get the attention of the science community, our funders, and our policymakers as well for truly high impact. And that's one of the reasons that I think all of us as individual researchers need to think about how we work in this big data landscape. So this is an example of Lizzie Wolkovich and a large group of colleagues who got together to synthesize the results of warming experiments that occurred at small scale with the phenological responses of plants that are actually observed over time, and found that experiments actually underpredict the response that we've seen in phenology of plants around the world in response to climate change. And this had a lot of impact in the scientific community. Of course, is published in one of the high-profile journals, and can help to, among other things, can help us to better design experiments, and has led to proposals and really a lot of attention in this area. So truly, as an individual scientist, we do need to be thinking about how we make our work higher impact, and one of those ways is by being integrative and collaborative. So data really advertises your expertise, and you know, my sense of this in particular is I don't have a study to show you where we did a rigorous study of this phenomenon, but my experience is coming from 8 years as deputy director of the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis. And that center is the first National Science Foundation Synthesis Center. This is a center that was set up by NSF explicitly to foster collaboration, data sharing, more integrative and synthetic thinking in ecology, and was highly successful by every metric and still is at now 20 years after establishment. And so I was there for 8 years facilitating dozens or probably hundreds of working groups that were working on these sorts of big synthetic question-driven research together. And this is the phenomenon that we saw, was that when somebody saw that an investigator had a large data set, they might not have been the first person who got an invitation to a collaborative working group if perhaps they didn't have, you know, the cutting-edge data handling skills that the rest of the working group members have. But the idea that they had expertise around a particular topic, and that they had advertised essentially that they are a very collaborative person by publishing their data, those people became well known. They have excellent reputations in our field and are invited repeatedly to collaboration because, you know, by and large in ecology, the people who are doing these large-scale synthetic analyses where they're using other people's data have a general principle that they would contact the people who have those data and ask them to collaborate, because we all recognize that once you look at somebody's data, you've got all these different questions, and you know, since you didn't study it yourself but you have your own area of expertise, you recognize that somebody else who's a real expert is going to bring a perspective to your analysis that you really need. And so what we largely saw was people reaching out for collaboration, and that these did become true collaborations where the data providers were also providing their expertise. So perhaps not getting hands-on in the analyses at some times, but able to provide interpretation that is absolutely critical to the final outcome being a terrific scientific product. So in situations of disaster tend to highlight the strengths and weaknesses of information availability. And in 2010, in the initial days and weeks and months of the Deepwater Horizon spill, I think the scramble for information was evident across all sectors of society. And of course, a lot of what happens in that process is necessarily behind shut doors, so I don't really know how much data sharing was happening behind those closed doors. But what I do know is that citizen science suddenly had a very prominent face in this issue. And within a few weeks of the beginning of the Deepwater Horizon blowout, when people were trying to think about what the environmental impacts of the oil spill would be, these citizen science bird counts were integrated with modeling efforts to understand where the oil was and where it was going to go, so that they could look at, and this is from eBird, so that they could think about where the brown pelicans were typically located along the shoreline and other species of that were vulnerable to this threat, and try to focus efforts and public attention towards those areas. And of course, you know, my reaction was twofold when I saw this. One was that this is fantastic, what a great display of data, and in an important issue. And the second was, how much more relevant would scientists be to society if professional scientists' data were available in times like this? So what do we do? If we're in administrative positions, I have some administrative responsibilities. We can think about the institutional incentives, the cyber infrastructure that needs to be built, how to facilitate cultural change and training at institutional levels. As an individual, you yourself have the power to organize and archive your data for posterity. So not just for that study that's just coming up, but really thinking about 10, 20, 30 years into the future. We can get involved in collaborations that use heterogeneous data, start to think about how your data could be integrated with remote sensing data, for example. And we can make every effort to share data and begin to shift our local culture. And I would suggest that one really easy way to begin to shift your local culture would be to sit down with this paper, which is a really easy introduction to data management. And just talk with your local research group about the basic concepts in there and see if you can begin to implement them for yourselves. Thanks.
Any questions for Stephanie?
Yeah, it's a good one. Yep.
Absolutely.
Stephanie, what are your thoughts on budget guidelines in projects for data?
So, it's a tough question because if you haven't done it before, you don't necessarily know what you're going to need. And, you know, so in my case, I looked at other people who had data managers and then tried to create a scale, you know, what, you know, knowing the sort of data we would have, maybe I needed a tenth of what some other project needed, or maybe I needed twice as much. And so, you know, in our case, it was a full FTE for the lifetime of the project, and then I think we had a little bit of undergrad assistance. But I think it's going to vary enormously by discipline, and so the best advice I can give is to look towards, I mean, maybe your only examples are some of the really big projects, like, you know, I looked at an LTER budget and thought a little bit about what that person was doing relative to what I would need a person to do.
I guess as a follow-up, that would take care of the budget for the data within your, as long as you have hands on it. What are your thoughts on where data preservation and curation ought to be budgeted for in our collective search
center? That's the tough one, right? And I don't know that we've got that figured out. Somebody's got to pay for it,
yeah.
Right? I mean, it's so in our case, you know, we're in this situation where we can say, we're going to put this in Knowledge Network for Biocomplexity, which is a Data One member node or coordinating node, and so as long as data one exists in one form, it's not even important that K and B, that our particular repository, exist. And so we're sort of saying, okay, this is the best we can do, but over time, who is going to carry the burden of that data archive, and that is something I don't have an answer for. I'm not surprised you would ask me such a tough question like that. That's a good one. Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Thanks.